You're listening to The Leonard LoPate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
It's estimated that drug violence has claimed at least 28,000 lives along the U.S.-Mexican border since President Felipe Calderon took office in late 2006. Last year, in the wake of increased violence, the United States promised to take added steps in preventing the flow of weapons and drugs, including $1 billion in aid. But by most accounts, the drug war is far from over. In his latest book, A Mexica, War Along the Borderline, veteran journalist Ed Villaami offers a ground-level account of the corruption, narco-alliances, and uncontrolled violence that have taken over the region. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux, and I'm very pleased to welcome Mr. Villaami to our show today.
Good day, and thank you very much.
Explain the title of the book, A Mexica. Aren't the two countries very different?
Well, it's a play on words, of course. It's about the borderland. It's about this extraordinary territory where the two countries meet. And it's a borderland that belongs to both countries, but sort of neither, in a way. It is its own territory, a place in its own right. excuse me. And I wanted to play with the words in that way. The frontier is harsh. It's a line in the sand or along a river, needs must, and getting harsher. But it's also porous. 1 million people cross it every day to shop, to visit relatives. And the two sides, the American and the Mexican side, sides, have as much in common as they do to divide each other. And that's why I coined the phrase.
And I just heard a report today that 1 in 3 people who cross the border illegally are caught, only 1 in 3. What are you, a Brit, doing covering this story?
Well, I was – it goes back to the early years of the 2000s. I was a correspondent here in New York for The Observer and went down to – and wanted to write a book with that title. Nothing to do with the narco war. It found me rather than the other way around. You may remember that window at the beginning of the presidency of George W. Bush. He wanted to allow the Mexican truckers into and throughout the United States instead of the haulage system they have now. This is, I should have said before, perhaps the busiest commercial border crossing, but border in the world as well. And that's when I became fascinated by this, if you like, the contradictory porosity and harshness of the border. So I wanted to write a book about a place, and it's ended up being a book not so much about the war and the violence as the place in time of war.
How much of the border is fenced off today and how much remains open?
It's about 600 to 700 miles is actual physical fence. Much of the terrain makes it impossible to cross. And the attempts to, or the plans to create a sort of a virtual fence, a sort of cyber fence, have run into trouble and are almost over now.
Although a large part of this area is really dangerous to cross and people die crossing even if they're not caught.
Well, before the drug war escalated or intensified into its current frightening phase, migration was very much the theme that preoccupied most people. And the three so-called operations during the 1990s in San Diego, El Paso, and in the Rio Grande Valley sort of, as it were, throttled the urban crossings, if you like, the safer ones in terms of terrain, pushing migrants out across the deserts. And yes, thousands have died.
And those three American cities are sister cities to three Mexican cities, Tijuana, Juarez, and Nuevo Laredo. But has all of have all the problems spilled over into the American cities, or have they remained very much on the Mexican side?
Well, it varies from place to place. the most remarkable contrast is between El Paso and Ciudad Juarez. Ciudad Juarez has more homicides per capita than any other city in the world now, and El Paso is the second safest city of its size in the United States. So no, it hasn't.
Why do you think that is? Because I would think that people are crossing back and forth, people who it actually might be easier to kill if you wanted to kill somebody when they're on the El Paso side than when they're on the Mexican
reasons.
Side.
The people who are crossing the border for reasons to do with smuggling drugs into the United States or people or both, they want to get clear of the border as quick as they can. So you'll find that there have been far more problems with, say, kidnapping of migrants and extortion of them in Phoenix than there have been in Nogales, Arizona, which is right on the border. there are also complications in Juarez. Juarez is not really a battle between cartels for the smuggling routes anymore. That's a sort of headline thumbnail sketch. It's an implosion of society, a fragmentation of violence. And it does not cross the border, I think, for reasons economic. Also, let's say it. The United States border security operation has not been nearly as ineffective as it's sometimes accused of being. There are people doing a very good job down there.
Well, let's talk about the players in the drug war. You mentioned cartels. That usually suggests something similar to what we had in this country with the mafia or what was happening in Colombia. But I get from the book the fact that there are a lot of cartels here. Some of them are fairly small. They're all fragmented. They're not working together at all?
Yes, I think this is what I'm trying to say, among other things, in the book. It's narrative, it's reportage, it's faces and places, most of it. But in as much as it does have a gist, I think we need to get behind this, as I said, this headline of the war between cartels for smuggling routes into the United States. Yes, there was, 25 or so years ago, a sort of a pyramidal system, what the Italians call a pax mafiosa, the mafia's peace. Everyone knows their place, cartels, politicians, police forces, whatever. That fragmented into a number of rival cartels, each with their own allocated plazas or turf along the border. And that has now fragmented even more so. The cartels are pastiches of legal corporations in many ways. They're after the same stuff, after all, do re mi. And they have now fragmented, outsourced. They outsource their own tenders to the street gangs who have to fight for the tender to work for the cartels. And a street gang does that in rather a different way to a cleaning corporation that wants to wash the streets. And so they've become sort of pastiches. And much as the legal economy has, if you like, fragmented, they've gone free market. They've gone lean and mean. And they've fragmented with disastrous consequences.
Well, some DEA officers in Mexico authorities say that the fragmentation of these cartels is a sign of their weakening. Do you agree?
Well, and this was the premise at the beginning in December 2006 when President Felipe Calderón sent in the Mexican army to crush them. The idea was, and the DEA or elements in it share this view, that if you fragment, if you whack that ball of mercury, if you like, and create lots of little splinters of mercury whizzing all over the place, you weaken them. That was the premise. Actually, in the event, especially in Ciudad Juarez, it's more like particles in a nuclear reactor, to be honest. Although as we go east, it's not a uniform situation at all. If we go east or southeast, down into the Rio Grande Delta and Tamaulipas in the northeast of Mexico, where we have the Gulf Cartel and Los Zetas, a terrifying development, the first narco paramilitary army, if you like, there we do still have, if you like, pyramidal, classic narco cartel.
How far into Mexico does this go? Does it go to Chihuahua and other major cities nearby?
Well, it's concentrated on the border, but it has spread and is spreading. Places that people quite rightly associate with being beautiful coastal towns, Cancun, Acapulco, they've seen their share of violence. Guadalajara has seen its share. Michoacán, which is the president's home state, has a particularly vicious a syndicate there called La Familia, a famous, who had their coming out party, as is famously recounted, was to roll five decapitated heads across the floor of a discotheque one fine evening.
What, to let people know that they were around?
Yes, a sort of a declaration of presence, if you like. And there's a lot of this posturing, this almost black humor of the way that they use sometimes innovative cruelty and sadism to announce themselves, both physically and on YouTube, on the internet, with these banners and messages that they hung. There is a macabre black humor to it all, which I think is indicative of what this war, this fighting is about and indeed isn't about.
My guest is Ed Vulliamy, V-U-L-L-I-A-M-Y. His book, A Mexica, War Along the Borderline, is published by Farrar, Straus and Giroux. Now, when you mentioned a paramilitary group, and immediately I was reminded of Colombia. Well, with Colombia, there was the cartels were defeated. It took a decade, but it happened with the help of the United States, and the extradition was pivotal in bringing the Colombian cartels down. What's happening in Mexico? Why isn't it working there?
Well, in Colombia, the relative success was due to, I think, a president of exceptional ability in some ways. There were pyramidal structures within the cartels, the two main ones, certainly Cali and Medellin, whereby one could negotiate deals. One could perhaps, one has to be careful here, one could perhaps suggest that they went into construction rather than the other things they'd been doing, or that other lucrative arrangements could be made. I'm treading carefully. And it worked, as you say, after a protracted 10 years. Well, we're now 4 or so years into this. We're about coming up to the anniversary of the major mobilization. Why isn't it working? The reasons are multifarious. Partly, it's to do with, I think, the economic backdrop to the violence.
Two Mexican journalists you spoke to drew parallels between the drug war and capitalism. What were they telling you?
Well, yes, they did. And one doesn't want to oversimplify that line of thinking. But to ignore the economic backdrop is to avoid answering your question. On the border, at least, and briefly, I'll summarize, there were these bonded factories. They're called the maquiladoras, assembly plants whereby exports to the United States can go duty-free. They were sort of NAFTA before NAFTA, if you like. And what they did was create these urban monsters, Ciudad Juarez in particular, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people, coming from the desperately poor interior, not to cross the border, as we always hear about, but to work alongside it in these plants. They have started to shed labor now. They can do it more cheaply elsewhere in Central America or even in Asia. So you have these cities that burgeoned with no real infrastructure to house, and crucially, no schooling for children. So you have generations that either left school at 9 or never went to school. And they're starting to depopulate. And the cautionary tale is, you know, those problems that deindustrialization in the United States or South Wales or Liverpool are accentuated, deepened by the fact that there are jobs going. There are jobs going in the drug trade. There are jobs going by making your addiction an economic activity. This is catastrophic. And I think this is probably why the Mexican attempt to crush the cartels has failed, or at least in part.
And an earlier guest told me that if you want to go to school, if you're young and you want to go to school, it costs money. So there are very few options for you. And this is one way to make some money. And if the more violent you are, the more money you're going to make.
Absolutely. I mean, if you just be vernacular about it, there's a place called Riberas del Bravo, which is right up against Texas, on the east of Ciudad Juarez. It's built on a marsh for reasons that are totally corrupt in the first place. It was a cotton paddy field. There you have, yes, the maquiladora assembly plant labor is going, is shedding. You have children who cannot go to school because their parents can't afford to send them. And also because it takes, Juarez is like a fan. You can't get from one satellite town to another. It takes maybe 4 or 5 hours to go to school and back. These things matter a lot. So they don't go to school. Then they get the tap on the shoulder. Yes, bit of money. If we give you some drugs, you can take some and cut them and sell them on. You can get a little bit if you're taking part in a kidnap, maybe kidnap yourself, maybe then start killing. And so you have a sort of a pay grade of a terrifying kind.
But what is this really all about? You say in your book that the Mexican drug war is really about nothing. I would have thought it was about control, power, money, supplying a demand in the United States.
Yes, at root it is. But these cartels have mutated. We've come a long way from the Don with his fedora, who perhaps gives money to the children or flowers to the ladies on Mother's Day. No, these are cartels. They've mutated. They're leaner and meaner. There's a new generation. And I met a young man in Reynosa, in Tamaulipas, in the Zeta country, and he said, "Don't underestimate the cogency of the fact that this kid, who's out of his head, don't forget, can't be seen in that $300 T-shirt Armani he had last year. He's got to have the $500 Valentino one this year because that chica won't look at him seriously enough. And then that progresses to this SUV, gets you this, and that the other SUV doesn't." Don't underestimate that. And that got me thinking, what is this about? These are now tiny bits of turf. Very important to say, by the way, that there's something perhaps not taken seriously enough in the US and a taboo in Mexico. These towns are blighted by catastrophic levels of addiction to hard drugs in themselves. They're out of their heads, a lot of these people. And it matters to them. And I was thinking, what sort of war is this? It's post-moral. It's post-political. It's a mutation of the sort of culture of hyper-materialism and greed, which is not discouraged by the leaders of our society. At street level, it is about kudos, social kudos of the most, I think, meaningless kind.
Forensic pathologist you spoke with, explain the difference in the narcos of the old days and the ones who control the region today.
Yes, this is a man in Tijuana, and what a man he is. He sees the world with alarming clarity from the slabs on which the corpses are laid for his analysis. His job is to try and read the mutilations of the corpses or of the living people as they were being killed, to work out what kind of signs the killers might have been leaving, who they might have been. When I talked to him at one point, he had a cheerleader and a model who'd had her fingers cut off during interrogation.
This is a lunchtime show, so we've got to say there's a lot of horrendous stuff in this book. But we can't go into detail.
No, we won't. I'm so sorry. And there is also an element of pornography in the way it's reported, and I don't want to be part of that. He just thinks if it's been done badly, it's not the real thing. But I'm sorry. I apologize.
No, it's okay. I was going to make that point because it's really important to read these things in this book. To get a sense of just how horrible the situation is. Yes. But
not when you're trying to have a sandwich.
Not at lunchtime.
Forgive me, please. I'm sorry. But no, his point was an interesting one. He sees the, if you like, the classic narco, the Don, the Corleone figure that we're all so familiar with as a sign of a time when there was an order to the criminality. That's not a contradiction in terms. And what he talks about now is a complete anarchy in the criminality, a breakdown of those values, however perverse and violent. And I don't like this glamorization of the old dons at all.
But these new guys are being glamorized as well in song. And I would assume it's harder to fight a war against something that is so split up and so anarchic. In the old days, you could go after a few leaders and their henchmen, and you might pretty much have stopped an illicit group cold for quite a while, if not forever.
Yes, which is very pertinent to your point about Colombia, because that's pretty much what happened there. These people are indeed idolized in the most revolting way that echoes or pastiches the celebrity culture that we have in the quotes-unquotes legal economy. And this is very, very frightening.
My guest is Ed Vulliamy. His book, Mexica, War Along the Borderline, it's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux, and we will continue our conversation after this. My guest is Ed Vulliamy. His book, Mexica, War Along the Borderline, published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. There have been many reports of corruption within the Mexican police and government officials in the area. How widespread is that?
It was ubiquitously widespread and is now widespread. It's difficult to know who's working for who. It's labyrinthine. The police forces were often at the service or pleasure of the cartels before the army went in. Part of the Mexican government's plan was to try and militarize the police. In Tijuana, for instance, putting a colonel in charge of the police force, they have an iron fist of a general there. And his methods have not exactly been kid-gloved, should we say, but it has, to a degree, quietened things down in Tijuana. In Juarez, however, the opposite is the case. The army goes in, and then the more the reinforcements are increased, it's like a Newtonian reaction. Equal counterforce, the violence gets worse. So it's very hard.
And the police are targeted, at least the ones who are not in the pay of the cartels. In the past, there was a lot of talk about the fact that police were paid so poorly that it was really tempting to work with the cartels, to tell them what was happening, when a raid was going to happen or whatever. But so much money is being poured into this area, $1 billion over a three-year period as part of the Merida initiative. Is that any of that money going to police salaries?
Not that I know of. The Merida initiative has to be for federal institutions. It's not supposed to be used for the municipal police, the state police. So it's restricted to federal law enforcement. I have to say, we've perhaps inevitably talked about the the tribulations and the darknesses of this abyss into which Mexico's going. I mean, that I'm of the belief that it would be hugely beneficial if some of the resources went into realizing that this thing, if it is going to be solved, will be solved from the ground socially. I care about this, and I think people should care about this, because the borderland is such a wonderful place. This matters. It's a place of bright colors. The people are delightful. The welcome is warm. The smile is ready. And weirdly, the worse it gets, the brighter those colors are, the readier those smiles. There is a resistance to what the cartels are doing. It's a materialist war. It is opposed by very, very brave priests and pastors. It's a male war. It's opposed by wonderful women. I'd love to see some of the aid take that kind of idea on board, but also education. It sounds trite, it sounds simple, but there are too many children, as we said before, not going to school. That would seem to me the obvious priority.
Well, there was a time not all that long ago when many Americans went to Mexico, were in love with the culture, in love with the food, and vacation there, and we're seeing a lot less of that because of this. What led to this change? Is it there were American drug addicts 20, 30 years ago, so it can't just be that. Is it something else? Is it the fact that weapons now flow so easily into Mexico from the United States?
Yes, and I think that in a way people should love Mexico and Mexicans. I mean, it is a wonderful country in so many ways, and all those reasons why the people of my generation loved to go to Tijuana, Juarez, and the Tamaulipas border towns.
Well, Oaxaca.
Oaxaca. Oh, absolutely, and that hasn't changed that much. I mean, one doesn't want to be responsible for advising people to go to particular place and something awful happened, but there's no reason not to go to Chiapas or Oaxaca or Puebla or Veracruz, or these wonderful places. They're as wonderful as they ever were. And important to say, there are places along the border that are much less affected than the ones we've been talking about. Mexicali, opposite Calexico in California.
And why would that be?
Well, there are two conflicting, or perhaps not conflicting, possible answers. One is, as people say, that Mexicali in particular is so uncontestedly under the control of one cartel that things remain calm. So you're back to the Pax Mafiosa, if you like. But then on the other hand, so are towns in Tamaulipas under the control of the Gulf cartel, and they're not at all quiet. I wouldn't suggest anyone go to Reynosa for a Saturday night out. But it does matter, and you rightly draw attention to the fact, these places are 15 minutes walk from the United States. It takes 10 minutes to get from El Paso to Ciudad Juarez on foot. Another reason for the surreality of it all. But the good people make it important, because the things you've mentioned and the reasons why so many Americans love to go to Mexico can't be lost. And wouldn't it be awful if the precious nature of this border culture, this place where the countries come together and the whole is greater than the sum of the parts, were lost? Wouldn't it be awful if the students of now were the first generation ever in the history of both countries not to love and enjoy this border?
My guest is Ed Vulliamy. His book, A Mexica, War Along the Borderline, published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Ludit Lopate. Some believe that the increased violence in the region is simply a reaction to by the cartels, the harsher tactics taken by the government. Do the Mexican people support President Calderón's methods of law enforcement?
They have done. In some places, Juarez is not one of them, but Tijuana is. The army is popular. When it is pointed out that a lot of the corrupt police officers were rooted out by fairly brutal means, the word torture was used, most people thought, well, what the hell? If it gets rid of this scourge in our society, more's the better. On the other hand, as you pointed out earlier, quite rightly, these new look narcos, the ones who would rather have an appointment with a martial arts trainer than a politician, are idolized by other sections of society. There is this musical vein, the narco corrido, which is a sort of a glorification of what they do. And this applies to the guys now, not the old dons. So the culture is split, or at least one overlaps. You might find people who love narco corrido but hate the cartels. It's double, and it also plays on regional identities as well. The Gulf cartel is Tamaulipas, and if you're from Tamaulipas, even if you despise them, you might excuse them for being our bad boys and not the other place's bad boys.
You mentioned that there's resistance among women, but women have been entering the world of narco trafficking on their own and been engaging in some of this. On the other hand, women have been viciously targeted, especially in Juarez. Grassroots anti-violence groups refer to what's going on as femicide. Do we have any idea why these young women have become targets?
There are many theories. This, the awful story of the feminicidio, the femicide in Juarez, has been much reported on and discussed. Partly, we go back to these network, these assembly plants, these maquiladoras. The genders of the employees in these places is now pretty much 50-50, male, female. But at the outset, it was overwhelmingly female. And we had a situation where, as a friend of mine in Juarez put it, the man in a family, the young man, is economically impotent, sexually potent, and the women are earning a low wage for sure, but a wage nevertheless. They become the wage earner. Out of this and in the mire of drug addiction and a city that is deformed in its conception.
Just distorted machismo?
Or sort of misogyny. And there was a mutation of that misogyny into this horrific violence targeted against women, which goes on, by the way. Because it's no longer the headline, doesn't mean it's gone away. It continues, and it has spread throughout Mexico. There was an article recently in Proceso magazine about the continued violation of women in the home, in the street, as a sort of as a thread that runs through the tapestry of this overall violence. Other people call the feminicidio and the kind of violence involved as a sort of rehearsal for what is now being meted out to other people too, well, across all, irrespective of gender.
So not all the acts of violence are against people who have a stake in the drug war, but can we say that the environment that the drug wars have created have invited all sorts of other kinds of violence?
Yes, this is crucial. There is a particularly unpleasant language sometimes invoked by the Mexican law enforcement authorities, where in fact there's a general who said, why don't the media report these deaths as uno delincuente menos, one criminal less, rather than one more murder? This is particularly despicable, and particularly so because I found the most upsetting of all was the killing of the young people in the rehabilitation centres trying to kick this awful habits that they got involved in.
And why are they being killed?
Well, we just don't know. I went into one the day after the grito, the cry of independence last year. We were about 12 hours afterwards, and the blood was all still sticky. It's a lunchtime show. But why? Who? Bloody boot prints across the courtyard. No attempt to apprehend these people. This is a darkness. A darkness. There are theories as to who. In the involvement of the law enforcement authorities themselves is one. I'm not able to.
The law enforcement officers, forces,
corrupt, rogue police, rogue military. We just don't know.
You also write about religious cults like Santa Muerte, Holy Death. So is there a religion developing around the sensibility?
Yes. The media in the US, it tends to be sort of secular. And this is a deeply, deeply religious or spiritual place.
Well, it's a Catholic country.
It is a Catholic country. But as one of the mentors, a wonderful professor towards the end of the book, talks about folk Catholicism. It's multi-layered Catholicism with various faiths superimposed onto one another and the church and the indigenous faiths that preceded it. And the place is seeped in spirituality. The resistance is largely clerical. And indeed, yes, Santa Muerte is a cult. It's, I think, to be taken very seriously. Most Holy Death, it's a pastiche of the image of the Virgin de Guadalupe, the famous icon of Queen of the Americas, and is decked up to look like her. The candles, the votive candles look like hers. But she's on the other side, and you see her on car windshields, you see her on mobile phone holders, you see her around people's necks and on T-shirts. And she's kind of cool in this. It's a bit like having the Hell's Angels insignia on the back of your leather jacket.
I understand that some of the perpetrators even go to confession.
Yes, the relationship between the cartels and the church has always been a very strange one. If you're a big honcho in the old cartels, for sure, less so now. Yes, your children were baptized. Your relatives would be married by a priest. The church is actually starting to take this far more seriously. I think we should take more seriously what the church is doing than we do.
Just one more thing. I've heard it's very dangerous to be a journalist who writes what's going on in these areas. They kill the people who report on them?
This is very important, and we knock on wood. There are some very brave and excellent Americans based in Mexico City, and they're okay. None toward has happened to
what
them.
What about Mexicans
but,
and Juarez?
Yes, now we're talking about between 38 and 50, according to different estimates, journalists who've been killed. In Tamaulipas, in Gulf Cartel country, there is no reporting. It's as simple as that. The Zetas simply tell the editors of the paper, it's silencio. And a nice man who runs one paper called El Mañana says, well, what do I do? You say, I've got to report the truth, but if there's a possibility of us covering something, they'll kidnap a couple of my reporters covering weddings for the social pages. Families, what do I do? So they're silent. In Juarez, there is a remarkable institution. I mean, writing some things now, trying to get them nominated for the Pulitzer Prize. It's a paper called El Diario. And they keep going. They report on and on. One of their crime reporters was killed in 2008. Another one quite recently the other day, the paper put out an appeal to, they phrased it very carefully. They said the people running the organizations, they didn't use the word cartels. So they left it broad. What do you want from us? What can we say? Said the paper wrongly. Reported as being that we're giving up. They weren't giving up. They haven't given up. These are the bravest people in my profession, for my money. And
on the other hand, it does sound like this is a situation that's going to go on for a long time.
I regret to say it's looking into the abyss now. The bottom is not yet in sight. But wherever there is tribulation, there are remarkable brave people whose courage is always more interesting to me than what. Hannah Arendt called the banality of evil, for sure.
Ed Vulliamy, his book, A Mexica, War Along the Borderline, published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you, and for bearing with this as well, everybody.